Radio Ghana.
Behind the news live on Radio Ghana in Accra, my name is Abraham Asari. Welcome to the program, and in tonight's edition, granting tax amnesty to defaulting individuals and organizations. What are the social and economic implications? For providing poor services, telecom operators in Ghana have been slapped with 1.2 million Ghana cedi penalty, but some players in the industry have raised concerns. And do you know your HIV status? This is Behind the News live on Radio Ghana in Accra and all regional FM stations across the country. We are also live at gbcghana.com. You can send a text to us tonight, and the line is 026-441-8767. The line again is 026-441-8767. So no one can deny the fact that nations, whether developed or underdeveloped, rely largely on tax revenue for development programs. But over the years, some individuals and organizations have defaulted in paying their taxes. What contributes to tax default, and what goes into granting amnesty to such defaulters? Well, there are reports that the Ministry of Finance and Economic Planning is proposing a tax amnesty for tax defaulters. What has informed the Ministry's action, and which we gather, it's not the first time of its kind in this country. Let's speak to a tax expert, Ali Nachiap. Good evening to you, Mr. Nachiap. Welcome to Behind the News on Radio Ghana. First of all, can you tell us why people do not pay tax?
Thank you very much. The reasons why people do not pay tax may be varied, but there shouldn't be any reason for not paying taxes. The fact is that the government is saddled with trying to meet the needs of all the citizens. Talk about roads, security, peace, and keeping the stability of this nation all requires resources. So nobody has any excuse to enjoy all what goes with peace and security and not want to contribute to the maintenance and enhancement of all what we have. Generally, there are two views if it comes to taxation, what we call the benefit principle, that people want to see the benefit they will get from paying taxes before they pay. That would be a difficult situation. Some have the view that, well, I pay my taxes, but I have bad roads to my house, I don't get electricity, I don't get water. But paying taxes is more or less like an insurance. You pay in and it's used for the betterment of the unfortunate ones in the society. If they have more needs than us, then so be the distribution of the national cake. Some also look at the situation where we believe that paying taxes is a social contract. You have to pay and government will use it to provide for the resources. So don't look at what you would get. But the fact is that once you have the ability to pay, you have to pay. And your ability is measured by the fact that you have earned an income. And the state only says, give me a share so that I'll use it to better the environment for you so that you can make more money. So whichever reason anybody has, I wouldn't see why anybody would.
But apart from this benefit principle you are referring to, is there any other one? Is there a cultural problem? Ability to pay principle is also there.
That's right.
But is there a cultural problem? Is there a reason why people just don't want to pay tax? Is it something that has to do with that?
For cultural, I don't think there is a cultural reason why we do not pay tax. Because I remember a study that was undertaken by Dr. Raymond Atiguba on the tax culture in Ghana. And the conclusion was that Ghanaians generally love to pay taxes. How did he get to do that? He used as a proxy the collections, the tithe that we pay at church. You find out that if you're a Muslim, you go to the mosque, a Christian, you go to the church. When the collection bowl is coming, you are eager to put in something, no matter how small. But the idea is simply you know what you gain by belonging to that faith. And that is what has been the problem. That yes, the culture of paying taxes or contributing our quota to any society or organization we belong to, it's there.
So well, I'm not too sure whether that analogy will work, Mr. Nacha, because in the church house, for instance, people are made to go around and put their monies in a particular in a bowl. If you do not go around, you'll be found out as one who has not gone, you know, to give an offering. So I'm not sure that can be compared to the issue of tax paying, where you have to voluntarily walk into a tax office to pay your tax.
Yeah, but you see that it's voluntary because nobody comes to push you to get up and go and donate if you're in the church and you don't get up. And then in churches where you...
But you'll be found out if you do not.
No, but in churches where you do not get up, but the bowl is passed around, you sit in the pew, they give it to the head person, and then it moves on to the next, and it appears at the other end. How about that? Because not in all cases you get up, dance, and go and drop something. Or if you are in the mosque and in some churches, the places where the collection bowls are, as you walk in, you even put in before you go into the church. How about that one? Who sees you? Or even if the person gets up, gets there, and just puts their hand inside without dropping any money, you wouldn't see. Because what we believe in is that giving is an act from the heart. So we don't expect anybody to go to church to go and mock God and dance around and not put anything.
So
that is the culture for which we believe can be extended to tax paying. Because if you can't mock God in not giving and pretending to be giving, and we know the good book says that governments are established agents of God on earth to help us find our way out here, then we should extend that to be able to have the culture.
So whose fault is it then if Ghanaians naturally would want to pay taxes, but they are not paying? There should be a reason.
Yeah, the reason is what I'm saying, that Ghanaians generally would be of the benefits principle view, that we want to see what the tax money is being used for, to be encouraged to pay more. You understand? That is what I'm saying, that if they do the analogy using the church or the mosque, you know that if anything befalls you, you see how the fellowship would be like. They will visit you, sympathize with you, and try to assuage your pain. That is what they want to see government do, that if I have a problem with trying to get medical assistance, health care, what is government doing to assist me? I'm not getting water. How is government trying to assist me? That is what they want to be seeing. And that is what we are saying, that yes, indeed, if the demands exceed what has to be provided for, then it will be done in piecemeal situations. So what will be of concern to somebody is water. What is of concern to somebody is electricity. For example, if you look at the current new districts that I have mentioned, some are jubilating, congratulating government. Some are also up in arms saying, why haven't you declared that? Why is it cited here? So it shows that if you are even trying to meet the needs and wants of citizens, what somebody sees as his wants or needs will be different from the other.
So Mr. Nachiap, this tax default amnesty,
yes,
how is it going to help? You think it's going to be a motivation for people to pay their taxes?
I think so, because if you look at the proposition that came in 2006 under the late Honorable Baredu, it had an impact. And so I am of the view that if it is going to be repeated, that would be very good. The only problem which is going to be addressed this time, from what I have been reading, is that after you grant the amnesty, the question is, what happens to those who do not take advantage of the amnesty? Then you have to go all out and deal with them according to the law. Because you defaulted, it's not in all cases that it's intentional. Most of the time, cash flow constraint. So as you keep piling up the penalty of somebody who genuinely owes and genuinely has not got the cash to satisfy the tax, it's only prudent that you try to help the person meet their tax liability by waiving the penalty.
It could be a motivation for the defaulters. But how about the tax agencies, the collectors? I have always thought that they are also part of the problem. So if defaulters are going to be given an amnesty to come and pay, mm-hmm. For penalties to be waived, is that not going to be a demotivation for tax collectors to say that, well, even if you do not collect in future, they will be given some amnesty to pay?
No, I don't think it will be demotivating, because once it's a tax in arrear, as you sit as a tax collector, you have a shortfall. So if the person is being encouraged to own up and come and clear the backlog, it's to everybody's advantage that we can clear whatever is outstanding. The penalty is more or less a punitive action to try to let a taxpayer not go back to those ways. But if you keep compounding the penalty and I still do not make the money, what will be the next step? You lock up my business, lock up the offices, and so how does the money come? And remember also that when we look at tax collection, it's not only the taxpayer as in the income he or she or the business has earned, but the taxpayer is at the same time an agent of the revenue, collecting withholding taxes from payments to suppliers for government. So as much as the person might be owing his own taxes, he is still helping in tax collection through the withholding tax system. So give and take, we still need them to help us collect the revenue.
But then, do you not also think that maybe our system of paying taxes is problematic? You do not expect somebody who owes you to walk to you. Some people do not have that attitude or that culture of getting up and coming to you to pay your money if you do not go to collect it. So why don't our tax collecting agencies become a little more proactive, and go after the taxes, go after those who owe taxes, are they not demanding to collect the tax?
Yes, I agree with you. The proactiveness is being realized of late, considering the fact that some of the offices are now computerized, and looking at the eGov, eGhana project, where they are going to link up Registrar General to Ghana Revenue Authority to all sectors, then we would be able to even get online payments, real-time payments. And people can also access the bank accounts of the Ghana Revenue Authority and even make the payments through transfer, and then taking the receipt to show as evidence of having paid the taxes. Then they can amend your tax file to reflect the payment. So in as much as we agree that there should be that proactiveness, it all comes with logistics, where they have to be provided with vehicles and be able to move from office to office. And in most cases, when you move about like that, it also brings the idea as if you are antagonizing the taxpayer. But if you look at it, the tax offices have been open in as many branches as possible, in as a principle to get the tax office as close as possible to the taxpayer. If you take the road from Accra to Medina, for example, or Adenta, you have an office at Ringway Estates, you have an office at Legon, you have an office at Hollywood, that's Medina Zongo Junction, you get another at Adenta. So whichever angle you are looking at, you have an office close to you. And so I think that a lot has been done to make sure that tax offices are close enough to make payment more friendly.
Mr. Nachabi, thank you very much for being with us tonight on Radio Ghana. Enjoy your evening. Ali Nachabi is a tax expert. Now, Bernard Anaba is a policy analyst with ISEDEC. Mr. Anaba, welcome to Behind the News tonight. What is your view on this policy, if it should come, into effect? Do you think that a tax default amnesty is a good way to collect taxes?
Yes, I think it's a good way. It's not the first time, and it's not going to last, and it's been practiced in other countries. For example, in 2009, Italy gave a tax amnesty and was able to rake in about €5 billion. So it's a good policy to actually help to raise revenue. So I think, and also as Ali Nachia said, in line with the e-government initiative, it's also good that you bring people who otherwise wouldn't have come forward to pay taxes because they are defaulted.
Well, but in spite of that, we understand that the last time it was implemented, taxpayers were a bit suspicious of the policy. They thought that it was going to be used as a pretext, to have them punished, rather. And so many did not come forward to pay.
Yes. So it boils down to education. I mean, if they are told the real essence of this amnesty, then they go forward to that. So I think it's an issue of people understanding what it is about. And this time around, I'm sure the tax or the policy, the Minister of Finance, trying to get as much many people as possible coming to register, and as they are granted amnesty, then they stay on the register and find a new lease.
Mr. Anaba, I'm afraid your line is not the best for us tonight. Maybe you can, it would be better if you could reposition yourself. But then, I'm sure that the penalties that tax defaulters would have had to pay also could have given us some kind of revenue. We're going to lose that. How sure are we that what the amnesty will bring in could be more than what the penalties would have actually given the state.
Yeah, I'm sure the ministry probably have made a calculation and realized that getting more and more people coming forward to pay their taxes and letting go of the tax penalties probably will be worth more than actually going after this penalty. So I think by and large, having more and more people being willing to come forward to pay their taxes and to turn a new leaf and to begin to get into the stream of paying taxes regularly is more important than having to chase people. Because sometimes you look at the cost of even falling defaulted to pay their taxes. So that can actually outweigh the revenue. So it's a good policy in direction, especially if it is able to rake in more revenue than the penalties that would have been realized from that. And it's even difficult to get those penalties in the first place. So why not grant the amnesty and get the people coming in?
But still, tax evasion is a huge problem in this country. How do we make people pay tax?
Yes, it's a huge problem because we have historically we have an administrative problem, and as we all realize what the problem is, gradually we believe if everybody education, everybody comes on board, then we'll be able to move forward. It's generally a problem for developing countries. We don't have the requisite facilities. We don't have the people well trained tax auditors to actually assess businesses and individuals for taxes. But it's a development problem which we believe when we all put our hands to the wheel, we'll be able to solve that problem.
Ms. Anabawi, thank you very much for being with us tonight on Radio Ghana. It's been nice having you. Have a good night. Bernard Anabawi is a policy analyst with ICBEC. You're listening to Behind the News. This program is live on Radio Ghana and all of its regional FM stations across the country. GBCGhana.com. You're live on the internet. You can send us a text 026-441-8767. Behind the News live on Radio Ghana in Accra and beyond. Here are some of the text messages. This one says, Abraham, are those in charge of tax collection really working? Al-Hassan Bawa, says he, Bawa Krum, Akuntumra. There should be sanity among tax officials to win the trust of taxpayers. Apusiga Albert Asibi, UDA's Y Campus. And this one from Odinke in Koko. If tax collectors would give proper account of what they collect to us, we would be encouraged to pay. You are listening to Behind the News, and it's live. For years, mobile phone users have complained about the poor quality of service of some mobile phone operators in the country. Sometimes the quality of service is so poor that consumers or mobile phone users sometimes the quality of service is so poor that consumers or mobile phone users continuously appeal to the government to intervene to ensure that Ghanaian mobile phone users got the same quality of service that pertained in Europe and elsewhere. Well, the National Communications Authority, NCA, which is the industry regulator, at the weekend hit out the mobile operators in the country with a huge fine of 1.2 million Ghana cedis for poor quality service in parts of the country. However, the Ghana Chamber of Telecommunications, made up of mobile telecom operators in Ghana, is unhappy with the NCA. The chief executive of the chamber, Kweku Sechiadu, spoke to Behind the News a short while ago.
First of all, what the NCA seeks to do is to, or has sought to do, is and to achieve is what it calls first world quality of service. First world quality of service standard means that what pertains in developed countries in terms of the quality of telecom services is what ought to pertain in Ghana. We have absolutely no problem, no quarrel, no dispute with the NCA. We believe that Ghanaians deserve the best possible, the highest possible quality of service in telecommunications and indeed in all other services. So we agree with the NCA with that. But there are two issues. One is that the measurements used to determine those standards, we have problems with those measurements. And we have brought this to the attention. And we're not talking about one operator or two operators who have failed to meet the benchmarks and therefore are, you know, finding excuses. This is all of the operators. There's agreement across all the networks that there's a problem with the way the NCA measures these parameters. They are technical and, you know, it's not very useful to go into them.
But the benchmark you're referring to, is it not a standard that these companies or operators have signed up to with the NCA to ensure that, you know, the operations meet?
Yes, they are the standards that operators have signed up to. But we are not disputing the standards. We are disputing the measurement of the standards, how the technical approach, the instruments that are used, you know, to measure the standards are in dispute.
Mm-hmm.
That's the point.
Can you tell me what the standards are, what measurement tools are?
It's technical. There's one, for example, called traffic channel congestion. Okay? There's another one is about sampling, the sample size that the NCA adopts when it does what is called drive tests, which determines how many calls, in order to investigate how many calls drop in a particular area. You know, I think the more useful point is that the technical means or measurement by which the NCA arrives at the measurement, or by which it judges the operators, are in dispute. That, I think that's the critical point, that it's in dispute. The other point is that there are external factors that affect the quality of service, that which do not pertain in developed countries, but which exist here. For example, power outages disable the towers. You don't have power outages in the first world. We have backup generators that should kick in when there are power outages. People go and steal the diesel and go and sell it. That wouldn't happen in a developed country. People won't go and steal your diesel and go and stand by the roadside and sell it in gallons. In some instances, people are stealing the generators themselves. That wouldn't happen in the developed world. There are also fiber cuts, you know, the fiber optic cables that are laid, just like they steal ECG cables and so on and so forth. The people are stealing the copper cables which belong to Vodafone, but they're also cutting the fiber. Some people think they can do bangles or bracelets with them. There are also errors that happen because contractors are doing construction, road construction, and they, mistakenly cut the cables. These have far-reaching consequences.
But how prevalent are these problems?
They are prevalent. They happen all the time. All of the time.
And is the NCA aware of these problems?
NCA is aware of these things. We've been calling the attention to them. In fact, we have started all operators file their logs of the fiber cuts, for example. They send them to the NCA. They started sending them to the NCA. In the past, they were not doing that, but they started sending them to the NCA. They send some to the Ministry of Communications. They send some to the Chamber. You know, so I mean, from January to July, the first 6 months, for one operator alone, and we can use that as the average, there were 108 fiber cuts. It costs each operator an average of $140,000 every month just to repair the fiber cuts. That is not all. There's also the revenue that is lost when people are unable to use the services. Revenues lost to the operator and revenues lost to government, because then government loses the talk tax. That is not all. This is the worst part of it. There's also the damage to the reputation of the operator when people cannot access they cannot use their mobile phone services because the service is down. And, you know, these things will not happen in Europe or America because if there's road construction, you know, you don't have a situation where cables are laid anywhere other than the road reservation. When a road is done in developed countries, there's a road reservation that is protected for utility services, telecom services, and so on. Here, people build on them. People put containers on them. People put kiosks on them. You know, so the conditions here are not the same conditions that exist in developed countries. So we're suggesting that these externalities affect the quality of your service.
And so if these were considered, would there be need, then do you think there wouldn't have the need to pay penalties if these externalities you're referring to were considered by the NCA?
We've got to go beyond these specific penalties, because if you don't do that and we do not address these problems that I have listed, next year, the year after, even if you sack these operators and you bring in new ones, you face the same. You continue to find them, but the problems will not be solved.
But these issues are fixed.
Let me ask you what subscribers want. Do subscribers want operators to be penalized? Or do subscribers want their calls to go through? They want their calls to go through. But by penalizing the operators, does that allow your call to go through? It won't, because the problems that are impeding your calls, the rollout of infrastructure which will resolve those problems, have to be addressed.
But the one to address those problems is not the NCA. I believe that if there is theft, maybe you should report to the police and not the NCA.
I'm sorry?
If there's an issue of theft, of people stealing cables and gasoline and all that, that is an issue that should be reported to...
It is widespread. It is a structural problem. And arresting a couple of people and putting them in jail is not a solution. We are talking about a policy approach to resolving the problem. One other problem that I must raise is the district assemblies have business operating permit charges. They have levies which they impose on operators. Now, these charges are totally out of sync with, you know, they're just illogical.
Why?
Okay. For example, I'll give you one district. The business operating permit for, say, the banks is 2,000 Ghana cedis. Sorry, 1,000 Ghana cedis. For insurance companies, 700 Ghana cedis. For Ghana Water Company, 600 Ghana cedis. For mobile phone operators, it's a total of 22,500 Ghana cedis. How do you encourage or incentivize mobile phone companies to introduce or to roll out or deploy infrastructure which will improve the quality of service if you're charging so much? What is the incentive for them to roll out?
Is that for a single assembly? Or, you know,
this is one assembly. Out of today, there are more than 200 assemblies. This is one assembly.
And that was Kukuse Chiaro, who is the chief executive of the Chamber of Ghana Chamber of Telecommunications. Well, let's speak now to the NCA. Mauko Zomelu is the deputy director, consumer and corporate affairs of the NCA, and he's also joined us. Good evening, Mr. Zomelu. Welcome to Behind the News. So, how did the NCA measure the performance of these telcos?
Of the telcos?
Yeah, telecommunication.
How did we measure them?
Yes. What kind of a tool or, you know, measure did you use to arrive at the penalties that you have imposed on them?
Oh, we use mobile phones. And we don't use BlackBerries and those sophisticated phones that could cost. We use phones that anybody can buy and use. We use telephones, mobile handsets.
Yeah, so
we don't use what you call, is it iPhone or BlackBerry? No. We don't do that. We use the same phones that anybody, so that if somebody says that I'm having problems, you'll be able to measure the kind of problem that somebody is having in order to find a solution for that somebody.
So then, is there a standard that you or the NCA has agreed with the, or you know, with these companies to meet, which they have fallen short of?
Oh, I think you asked this question and Kweku has said it. Yes, I mean, even before they come for their licenses, they know the regime that they have to operate.
Yes,
they know the regime. They know. I think, yes, we appreciate the concern that telecom operators are raising, but it does not mean that if you default, if somebody uses good money to buy a phone, somebody uses good money to buy a chip, somebody uses good money to buy top-up unit, that person can be short-changed. No, that is not our mandate.
But how are you addressing the challenges that they are facing, which they say they have discussed with you?
Like bringing the fiber that is cut to NCA.
Well, they said they reported those thefts, you know, and the fiber,
You asked whether that should not be done to the police. Isn't it the police the best place to go to when it's cut, when these things are done? When unfortunately, for instance, a contractor cuts through some fiber, I think there are processes like going to court to ensure that it will not be repeated. You know, and let me state that I had a submission to the effect that we are trying to use first world standards. In the first world, in Europe, because they also experience cuts, in Europe, where these operators are coming from, well, Vodafone, for instance, has its headquarters in the United Kingdom, isn't it? They have now developed pipes that they pass these things through to avert those shortcomings. You know, so there are things they know. And so we expect that they will find solutions to them. Because at the end of the day, all we're looking forward to is value for money for the consumer.
Now, the issue of operating permit fees, 22,000 Ghana cedis, he says, for a single district in Ghana, is that not on the higher side?
You mean what the district assemblies are taking?
Yes.
Oh, I don't know whether it's on the higher side, because I think the district assemblies are also enjoined to create revenue. Right?
Yes.
And so I wouldn't be able to hazard that guess, whether it's on the high side or not. But as it were, we have constant meetings with the operators. Now, what it means is that all these issues come up, and we have to find a solution, collective solution, because we are all stakeholders in the industry. A country of a population, the last estimate of 24 million, mobile telephony density is over 19 million, meaning the mobile telephone has become an integral part of the Ghanaian. They use it for all manner of things. They use it for business. They use it for emergency cases. Somebody is involved in an accident. Somebody is attacked by armed robbers. All manner of things. And you have to ensure that there's no call congestion, so that if you want to put an emergency call through, you get it. You want to ensure that if you have an important business running, your call does not drop.
It's unfortunate we couldn't play all the interview we had with him, but he also mentioned the fact that these companies also have, you know, some goodwill towards the customer. They've been able to reduce their tariffs, keep dropping, you know, by the day. They keep reducing their tariffs all the time, and so they expect that these kind of gestures will be appreciated.
We do, and since we moved away from monopoly and engendered competition, we have ensured that there will be true competition in this country. In other places, even in developed places like the UK, they don't have such mobile phone operators that are engaged in competition. We believe in competition, and we believe that the tariff drops and all those things are as a result of competition. Why did we initiate mobile number portability? We had to do it. Because we believe that ultimately the consumer ought to have value for money. We appreciate, we are stakeholders. The operators will tell you that we have a very open door policy with them. That we always engage them, you know. But it does not mean, I mean, that's not the first time penalties have been instituted against your prison. We do it whenever they default. We sanction them. Except this time, a media house got a report and reported that, hey, a certain amount of money is being demanded by the regulator. So, and definitely, I mean, they will have to say something. I mean, we appreciate what the chamber is saying, but we have to regulate the industry.
But in publishing, you know, their weaknesses, the chamber is saying that areas where they did well, you did not mention those things. You didn't publish those areas.
I don't think the chamber has said so, because in our report, we stated the amount of investment the industry has made within the last half of the year. And it is hundreds of millions of dollars. And we stated it. And we even stated that the hundreds of millions of dollars were at the June exchange rate. And that was to create an effect for people to know that, yes, they are also doing their bit. But doing their bit does not mean that a consumer can continue to be short-chain.
We thank you very much for talking to us tonight, Mr. Zumelu. And you have a good night, Marco Zumelu, Deputy Director, Consumer and Corporate Affairs of the NCA. So let's now listen to what consumers feel. Chief Executive Officer of the Consumer Protection Association is Kofi Kapitu. Good evening to you, Mr. Kapitu. What is your view on the fines imposed on the telecom companies?
Let me say that I think it's a step in the right direction, where this is nothing unique to Ghana, where somebody or a regulator decides to sanction an institution that they have an oversight over. I'm a little bit baffled when Mr. Marco Zumelu said that a newspaper got a hint of their fines. I mean, with all due respect, NCA is a public institution. Everything that is public should be made public. I don't see why a newspaper should have a hit. This is something that you do on behalf of Ghanaians. So if it's the proper thing which you are mandated to do anyway, to go do this test and see which telecom or telco is not doing properly. And I don't see the reason why NCA should make it like it's a secret, but unfortunately, you know, it was leaked out. Yes, I'm aware of these things or these tests that they do. As far back as last year, I even have some of the findings from last year that indicated what company did well in the three areas that the test was conducted, meaning call drop, congestion, and then setup time. That is the basic standard that NCA uses to assess the performance of the telcos.
But what do you think, Mr. Kapito, what do you think? You may call somebody, the line may be off, but it could be because there is power cut somewhere. Do you solely blame these operators for that?
With all due respect, I don't think any telco has any excuse to tell me because power is off or power is cut somewhere. So I, the consumer, should go through the difficulties. Even if that's the case, I expect the telco to, first of all, apologize and even give the subscribers a refund for that time. Let me give you a typical example. Do you know what is BlackBerry services? BlackBerry, the BB.
Do you want it? Because I'm asking the question.
I'm just telling you that you said something. BlackBerry, the BB was off for a day and a half. In the United States and Canada, BlackBerry has been sued. So what is this excuse that you want me to accept the fact that a telco's whatever is not working? Like I'm saying, if that's the case, it's upon the telco to let the public know, to apologize to its subscribers and say, you know what, this was not intentional, forgive us, we are repairing it. In most cases, or in the other jurisdictions, subscribers or consumers will be compensated for the inconvenience. Do you experience that as a subscriber yourself in Ghana? I don't think so.
So to me, the NCA has done the right thing. We should all be happy that finally the NCA, whether by some wonders of the world that Marco claims that a newspaper got a hint, to me, that is not necessary, that it should be a secret that you are actually doing what you're supposed to be doing.
So
mandated to put a fine when the telcos default.
Now, by assessing, if you look at the performance rate of these companies, do you think that the penalty was harsh, or was it good enough? Could it have been better?
Can I tell you what?
Yes.
Let's not look at it whether it's harsh or not harsh. Let's look at it as, yes, if you do something wrong when it comes to the telcos or any other industry, the regulator has the right to put a sanction on you, whether harsh or not. Look, most companies don't want to pay any fine. Most companies don't want to be put in the public domain for the public to know that they are not doing well. So maybe this will actually make the telcos sit up and realize that finally, NCA, who's a regulator, is not going to play ball anymore. Okay, and the NCA will continue. I hope so that the NCA will continue to impose this sanctions on the telcos for the telcos to perform well. These things are used as a deterrent.
Mr. Capito, thank you very much.
Punishment. It's a deterrent that you will know that sure, if I don't bring my standard up, a penalty will be imposed on me.
Thank you so much, and have a good night. Kofi Kapitu, Chief Executive of the Consumer Protection Association. You're listening to Behind the News live on Radio Ghana in Accra. Before we go for a break, just a few text messages. Dasa Chavez in WA says the taxes on salaries are too much. The government should spare us with these very high taxes. Abraham, where will the 1.2 million Ghana cedis slapped on telecom operators go to? Shamiendi, taxes in Ghana always go into wrong pockets. George Ahanta, Kwame Krome. This one from Odenke Nikoko. Abraham, tell me, how do mobile phone users benefit from the fines imposed on the network operators? Selom Asamoah in Kaswa, knowing one's HIV status will help to promote a healthy relationship and clear fear and panic from the society, so an intensive public education should be carried out. This one, I don't understand why you should continue talking about taxes when the government doesn't care about the high school fees in Ghana. Jacob in University of Mines in Takwa. And final one for this session, Abraham, why is it that in Ghana they don't give tax returns to workers as is happening in other countries? If it is done here, it will encourage people to voluntarily pay taxes. Al-Hassan Sahak Malik Ape. Behind the News live on Radio Ghana in Accra. Are you a Minister of State, Member of Parliament? Are you a politician? Are you a clergyman or a clergywoman? Are you a medical doctor, or you are a lecturer or a professor in a university or a higher institution of learning? Are you a prominent member of society, maybe a journalist or a broadcaster? Do you know your HIV status? Well, since HIV was reported in Ghana in 1986, various national responses have been adopted to deal with the AIDS pandemic. Stigma and discrimination, however, remain the major hindrance to the fight against the pandemic. People are reluctant to undergo tests for HIV for fear of being discriminated against if they are found to be HIV positive. The Upper East Regional Minister, Mark Woyongo, has, however, thrown a challenge to the nation's skilled labor force and prominent members of society to know their HIV status. This, he noted, will help deal with the stigma and discrimination associated with HIV and AIDS. Mr. Woyongo is on the line. Good evening to you, Mr. Woyongo. Welcome to Behind the News.
Good evening.
First of all, would you like to set a pace by telling me your HIV status?
Oh, I did it 2 weeks ago, and fortunately for me, it was negative.
And that's why you had the boldness to ask everybody to check, because you are negative.
Well, I expect everybody to be bold, especially if you are not very promiscuous. I expect everybody to be bold.
And if you are promiscuous?
Well, it's people who are promiscuous who will hesitate to know their HIV status. But even then, I think that it's better to know than not knowing, because if you get to know, then you can start the treatment early, and it will be good for you.
But why are you singling out prominent people in society? Why are you not asking everybody to go test for HIV? Why do you think that the Minister of State should go and test?
The ordinary man looks up to us, and it is just because for some time now we've been trying to educate people on the need for us to eschew the stigma, the discrimination, but it's not working. And I think that as leaders, we should lead by example. If we readily go out there to do the random testing, the ordinary man will say that, oh, after all, the big men are doing it, we can also do it. And I think that should be the way. And that's why I'm appealing to my colleague politicians, my fellow brothers and sisters, whether they are lawyers, they are teachers, no matter their profession. Because AIDS doesn't discriminate. And it's not only through sex that you can have AIDS. You can go to the barber shop and have AIDS. You can go for this manicure and pedicure and have it. So it doesn't really depend on whether you are promiscuous or not.
By the way, it took you such a long time to test yourself. Why?
Oh, no. I've been testing. I've tested each time I get the opportunity. I test. Even when I was in the United Kingdom, I went for testing. I mean, just to convince myself that I don't have a problem.
So it's become a lifestyle, sort of. You just keep testing.
Oh, yes. I mean, once in a while, it's good to assure yourself that after going to a barber shop, after going for manicure and pedicure, nobody has contaminated you. So, I mean, that assurance is good. I mean, that self-confidence is good.
Now, you are the head of the Regional Coordinating Council for the Upper West Region. Do you have a workplace policy on HIV and AIDS?
Well, we have a focal person in the office for HIV AIDS. We even have a pickup for our work. I mean, the office has a pickup for public education, you know, and we put a premium on HIV AIDS education, you know, at the RCC and the Regional Coordinating Council as a whole. That includes the municipal and district assemblies.
I think one major issue, you know, for this discussion is the discrimination that people who are HIV positive suffer. Are you ready as the Minister of the Upper West Region to go look for somebody who is HIV positive, employ him, you know, and give him work in your office to do? Just to do our way to help fight discrimination.
Oh, I've been interacting. They have an association. They have a union here.
So are you going to employ one of them?
Remember. Hello?
Are you going to employ one of them at the Regional Community Council?
No, I mean, if there's a vacancy and one of them applies, I don't see why we should discriminate against them.
I see. So, moving on from here, Mr. Woyongo, do you think that this fight against HIV and AIDS is winnable?
I think it is. We just need to persevere. We need to continue with the sensitization. We need to continue educating our people. I think it is winnable. And I think it's winnable if we all put our shoulders to the wheel. We should not just leave it to just a few people. Everybody, whether you are a teacher, you are a politician, you are a religious leader, everybody should get involved. And I'm sure we'll win the war.
But do you not think that your colleague ministers, for instance, might think that you are making this call because you think that, you know, they have such a lifestyle that doesn't all go well for their office, and that's why you want them, you know, to go test for HIV?
No, I think that my colleague ministers will buy into the idea. I'm sure a lot of them think the way I think. So it shouldn't be a big deal. I mean, maybe other professions, but as for the politicians, I don't think that they will make too much qualms about it. So it's just an appeal. It's an appeal I'm making to my colleagues. This morning, some radio station called and was asking me whether I think that, you know, a law should be passed compelling politicians to do compelling them to do this testing. And I said, no, if you do it that way, then civil rights leaders will say, oh, you are violating the rights of people. You know, it's got to be voluntary. we need to sensitize the people so that they will go out there voluntarily to test, you know, to know their status.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wayongo. I'm sure that maybe, I don't know when again you go for a test. Is it a regular practice? Are you going to go after 3 months, 6 months?
Oh, when I go to a barber or I go to do pedicure and manicure and I'm not sure of the equipment that is used,
you go for
I will. But this time around, I think I'll be more careful when I'm going to do that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wayongo, and you have a good night. Appreciate Regional Minister Mark Wayongo.
It's a pleasure.
So let's now speak to the Ghana AIDS Commission. Dr. Ruchi Damenya is the Director of Technical Services. Dr. Damenya, welcome to Radio Ghana tonight. Do we have statistics on voluntary testing of HIV for HIV?
Yes, thank you very much for the opportunity. I think I would first want to applaud Honorable Minister for showing leadership on the issues about HIV. I am not amazed because when we went to the Upper East region to do a dissemination of the National Strategic Plan, it was a whole day's program, and he sat there the whole day as the minister demonstrating his support and commitment to HIV in his region. So I wasn't surprised at all when he made the call that his colleague ministers should go for HIV tests. And almost everybody making that advocacy that we should all know our HIV status, because that is where it starts from.
So the question I asked is, do we have statistics on voluntary
testing? Certainly, we have information about those who have done HIV tests in Ghana. And as I speak, more than 1.2 million people have so far had HIV tests done. And this information is with the National AIDS Control Program through the health system. And I say that even though we have a high HIV population in Ghana, that is about 220,000 Ghanaians estimated to be living with HIV, the numbers that have tested is quite low in our view, because the Demographic and Health Survey indicated that it's just about 4% of Ghanaian males who have ever tested for HIV in the past 12 months, and about 7% female. That was when the study was done in 2008. So Ghana is among the African countries with the lowest HIV testing rates. And so when you see a strong politician like Honorable Makowai Wayongo knowing this information and advocating for Ghanaians to go for HIV testing, I think the future of our national response is bright.
So then, this voluntary testing, is it for policy formulation and implementation, you know, reasons, or it is for the benefit of the one who goes to test for it?
Yes, I think that going for an HIV test is an individual decision, because it has an implication on the life of that individual. But even though the implication is on the individual, it goes beyond the individual, because the whole family, if that person is the breadwinner and the person gets to know is HIV positive, research has it that households with HIV positive persons actually move into poverty quickly, you know. So because it has an implication on socioeconomic impact of people, we think that it is critical that people get to know their HIV status, and through that they can avail themselves for the treatment opportunities that exist in our country. As I speak, we have more than 155 HIV treatment centers in Ghana, and I think that we have trained health professionals who can administer these medications. What we need is for people to become very bold and taking their lives into their hands by availing themselves to do the HIV test. And basically that is what the National Strategic Plan is talking about, because we know that for us to be able to reduce HIV incidence by 50%, it starts with people getting to know their HIV status.
Briefly before you go, briefly, Dr. Amenya, before you go, just briefly, you've launched the National HIV and AIDS Strategic Plan for 2011 to 2015. Do you have provisions to encourage prominent members of society to go test for HIV?
What I would want to say is that HIV testing is for everybody. It is not just for the politicians. It is not just also for young people. It is for people, most especially who are most at risk. Also, the basic thing here is that 2%, almost 2% of the Ghanaian population are infected, and so it is key that we do targeted testing. But
okay.
Here is the case: most of the time, we certainly do not know people within the general population who could be infected, because the virus stays with people for more than 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that is why we are openly campaigning for Know Your Status among Ghanaians. And
thank
through
you.
That, those who test positive would then go for HIV.
Thank
treatment.
You so much, Dr. Richard Amenya, Director of Technical Services at the Ghana AIDS Commission. And that brings us to the end of tonight's edition of Behind the News, which came to you live from Broadcasting House here in Accra. This program, as usual, and as always, is put together by Bri Tagama, Christopher Siedu, Edmond Tete, and Kingsley Obenche. Tonight, technical production was done by Nina Isua and Eric Kwashi. A summarizer is Samuel Essa, with moral support from Assistant Director of Technical Services, Fred Kumasi. My name is Abraham Asari. Have a good night.